Icon Art Radio with Alan Cobb, Donna Colby, and myself, Bill Teeple. We're broadcasting from Icon Gallery on the Fairfield Square. Our guest today is Jim Weidel. We have a show opening this coming Friday. It's contemporary realism. And Jim is one of our featured artists. We've drawn artists from all over the state. Jim lives in Fairfield, but he has quite a long history as an artist. And we might ask you to talk a little bit about your history as an artist, leading up to where you feel art is at today and where it's going and what you'd like to have to do with the transformation of art.
Sure. And first of all, I will just point out that for those of you who are listening on the radio, and you wonder, as I did, since this is really my first show, what these people are wearing and the circumstances under which this is being recorded, I would not have, in my wildest imagination, have predicted this scene which surrounds me. We are all in a large hot tub with special, Alan Cobb is an audio genius, he tells me. And he's managed to use expensive filters to nullify the watery and bubbly sounds. So the idea here is that we are in some kind of ecstatic condition. And I may just submerge because the feeling is really quite delicious.
Shall I pop another bottle of bubbly?
And who are these tuxedoed gentlemen who are providing our every need? Are these art students? Is that what we have? And
no,
how many are there?
They fly them in.
That's Icon. This is Icon staff.
Very nice. I should come more often.
Our support group.
Anyway, we digress, which in a way is actually not a digression, at least for me, since this is sort of my style. And you could fault me for it, but really, if you look at the way life unfolds, especially from an airplane, at say 5 to 10,000, whatever that is, feet. Mm-hmm. Alan, you're the numerical genius. Feet?
Yes, yeah, usually feet.
Okay.
If you're
and you look down and you see river systems, they just meander all over the place. So that's my license to find myself in a kind of ambling romp. We were talking about what, other than the luxurious circumstances under which we're all.
Well, we could just let you meander.
Well, okay. Here's a thumbnail sketch. I, like perhaps some of you, am hopelessly overeducated. I received an MFA from the University of Pennsylvania during the Pleistocene era. And I then went on to become involved in the art world, the art scene, the New York art scene, showed at Fishback for a number of years. And that was all quite in itself an education. I have returned to Fairfield just in the last couple of years by way of the Northwest Passage, having lived in Idaho and other distant planets. It's nice to be back. It is also probably germane to the topic that no one here has any plans. The policy here is we come in here with no notes or themes pre-established, and so this this could be a multicultural omnivorous affair. So bon appetit.
So I want to go back further, though, in your history. To
Pleistocene like, isn't further enough?
What kind of a little kid were you? What did you create and what did you perceive when you were a little kid?
Well, okay. Good question. Fair enough. And by way of an answer, I will just quickly refer to The Story of Art by E.H. Gombrich. I'm thinking some of you, some of my august company will be familiar with that 600-page tome written by a gentleman whose life spanned the entire 20th century. He was born in the early 1900s and died, I think, in 2001 or something at the ripe old age of 92. And he and don't be daunted, those our listenership who happen to also overlap into readers, it's 600 pages, but a gob of pictures. Full page, nice. And it's printed in by Faden, who's a fabulous publisher, so the quality is tops. But in any case, Story of Art, he starts out with, while he's a traditionalist, and maybe something of a throwback, it's a great read as a primer. But he starts out with a startling contention, and that is, there is no art, there are only artists. And I read this a long time ago, and I've sort of never really been able to fathom as to what he meant. Because indeed, a book that's 600 pages long, that's called, yes, The Story of Art, should it start out that way, is possibly the most wonderful contradiction of all, because it signals certainly to me and to other willing readers that art is fundamentally a contradiction. It manages to efficiently set up the right point of departure, because you're not going to be able to get in the street vernacular, get art if you're hoping to understand it intellectually. So he instantly derails you from that, which is truly marvelous, and so I've obviously spent a great deal of time failing to answer your question, Donna. But I will say that even a child, a young person maybe, or say a person in fourth or fifth grade, if he has an eagerness for art, and most of us do still at that age, formative age, that would be an introductory primer that I would recommend.
See, I thought that was an answer that. When you were 7 years old, you read this book, and it changed your life forever.
I think I read it in high school or early college or something. But in any case,
just an aside here, just to take off from here, we've noticed where it gets off track. I mean, I think where we might end up in this radio show or this one and another show is that there's a place where something got out of whack. I think it can begin about 5 years old, because that this thing of that art has to be something that can be explained by the teacher or by the parents, and so that the kids will think, I don't know what art is. Right. I remember thinking, I don't understand poetry. What is poetry? Does it have to rhyme? Yes. Or what are the rules? And I felt that same kind of thing about art, but the thing is, the kid is doing it. You got the brush, you got the blue paint, you're going splat at 3 years old, or at least you're filling in the coloring book. Or kids are making art in the natural way that it flows out. But then they run into this thing, probably 5, 6, 7, 8 years old, where people have to tell them what it is. And that's when the teachers start actually screwing it up.
Right.
Because it's obvious what it is. And as soon as we start to define what it is, and you just said you can't define what it is very well, then we start to screw it up.
Excellent point. Yeah, and while it might be possible to become visually literate and even perhaps astute, it's not a triumphant condition, nor would you categorize it or file it under an endeavor that has structural parameters. It is a language, but when we say language in our culture, in our Western culture, I think it instantly conjures the idea of grammar and syntax and a lexicon and preeminently verbal language. And I think that an artist is someone who rather soon tires of the limits of those parameters, who, if not tires, is frustrated by the assigned meanings of that language. And at that moment, and it's a critical moment, it's a threshold moment, because he's yet to discover that there's this plenitude and abundance awaiting him in this alternate language. But at that watershed moment, and it could happen when you're quite young or any age, you're in a twilight. You're kind of in a twilight zone of neither nor, no longer and not yet. And it's fascinating from the standpoint of education, because it's a phase. It's a kind of necessary phase of considerable confusion. But if you are in a supportive context, that confusion can be a lubricant or an accelerant to seek this alternate language. And there are, while Gombrich is fine in an initial discovery of ideas about art and the history of art, there are several truly wonderful contemporary writers who I'd be happy to recommend. Among them would be Dennis Dutton, Dutton. Everyone's feverishly nodding their heads.
I haven't read it yet, but yeah. You tell me it's good. I love the title.
It's plenty good.
What's the title again?
The Art Instinct.
The Art Instinct.
And he has a website. You must, all three of you out there who are listening, you must write this down. It's Arts and Letters Daily. It is quite a website, really. I think the Examiner, the London Examiner, ranks it as the number one website in the entire planetary system, which is always a danger, number one. But in any case, recommend that. Also, Julian Spalding. Both these books are quite recent. I think, in fact, Dutton's book is, Art Instinct is 09, January of 09. Mm-hmm. Julian Spalding's book is The Eclipse of Art. Both very readable and willing to take on contentious perspectives, points of view. Now, have I happily answered your question of my early childhood?
You've taken us on a nice journey.
All right, well.
And that's what counts on this radio show.
Parenthetically, I will rush to say that in kindergarten, Miss Hewitt, my kindergarten teacher, assigned us, I think it was probably one of the very first days, she assigned us, I went to a Catholic school. A show of hands? Okay. all all heathens. Okay. Any case, I want to tell, and so our assignment, Miss Hewitt, we got to remember we're like 5 years old, and she says, "Class, today we will draw. Each of you will draw a religious image. Something out of catechism, somehow out of religion. This is absolutely genuinely accurate information you're receiving." And so I did. I did the crucifixion scene, and apparently it has not survived. The shortcoming is that it is not Exhibit A. If it were, of course, I would hold it up to the microphone so that all of you could imagine what. But in any case, it was unabashedly detailed. Legend has it, and anatomically correct. So much so that in my enthusiasm, my ardor to achieve, you know, top dog status, I seem to have neglected an article of clothing. So that evening, my parents, and I was assigned parents, as perhaps some of you, my parents received a call from Miss Hewitt, and they were asked to come down to the school and examine this image. So that was like the first epical moment in childhood. And so, here's the thing. This is really true, and that is, when you're good at something, it's okay. In a way, it's wonderful, but it's also a curse, because you are distinguished in a separating kind of way. And so, from there on, in every class, and my father worked for IBM, and so we moved. He was, what's the word, promoted, as you Americans say. And we moved to various cities, and so it would happen again. And so while I enjoyed it, the emerging little ego structure enjoyed it, it also was isolating, and it created a kind of separation.
Well, he's filling out your question for you, isn't he?
Yeah. Well, and did you go off to some little refuge on your own in this, because
very
of that
much
social state, and just like endlessly draw?
It was all I ever did in school. Notwithstanding that, I managed to get decent enough grades, but I was forever drawing little lumber camps. I remember lumber camps, elaborate, you know, like Hieronymus Bosch lumber camps, and sausage factories, spelled with a W. Imagine. Yes.
Just talk through it.
Yes.
In a distant room.
Or yes. Savor it.
That's spell check, I think. Yeah, for the W. Right. Anyway, and then, gosh. It was also around fourth grade where I discovered Mad Magazine, and I became a true worshiper of, particularly of Mort Drucker. Mort Drucker was.
Which one was he?
He did the satiric.
Yeah.
He did the satiric movie bits, and his style was amazing.
This was after Mad had become a 25-cent magazine.
Yes, Yeah, and also I liked Dave Berg, The Lighter Side.
Berg,
of,
yeah.
And it might be mentioned that his daughter, Nancy, was an inhabitant of our magical kingdom of Fairfield for a number of years. So shout out to Nancy. Stuff like that.
Yeah, Mad played a profound role in my early childhood. The first issue was at a summer place that we used to go to, and every summer after that, I would find that issue in the stack of newspapers by the fireplace that was to be used as fire starting material, and I'd pull it out and read it again and marvel at how all of these rules that I had never thought of as rules were being broken and needed to be, and they were never safe again after that.
So when you encountered Mad Magazine, where did you go from the lumberyards and the sausage factory in your work? How did they influence you?
Excellent question. It is Gombrich's contention that all art starts basically as a representation of what we see. He calls it making and matching. And he'll go into this more in his book, Art and Illusion. So it's a good read, probably in a way better. But in any case, I would worship at the altar of Mad Magazine. I also looked at all the comics in the paper. And it didn't really matter if I didn't get it or care about the, you know, the storyline. I was looking at the style, and in fact there were strips that I shouldn't be reading at all, like girl strips, like Brenda Starr and like Mary Worth and stuff. But Mary Worth particularly was drawing so well, and they had like sports cars in there, and they had this thing cropping, which prefigured. In my timeline, Alex Katz and his severe cropping of figures and how that created a kind of compression and drama. So I loved Little Abner, you know, the schmooze and such.
Pogo. And did you read Pogo?
Pogo was really great.
Yeah.
And the swamp, you know, and just the effulgence of that scene.
I always liked that the characters in Pogo were able to poke through the border and reach into other cells and pull things out, or, you know, Albert Alligator would light a match on the border of the picture and light a cigar.
Excellent point, because it is not part of the charm, the allure, the sense of transgression and violation of the structure, the adult structure, which did not subsume in at least in my life artists. I knew of no adult artists growing up, and the only affirmation of the value of art was in the many, you know, art fairs that all of us entered, and some of us won, you know. And there was a woman I was in sixth grade, and I happened to win one of these fair, you know, kid grade school contests citywide. It was Kansas City, and it was of a gas station with tires piled up, you know, used tire. And the woman's husband worked for Uniroyal Tires. And she wanted that drawing, and I'm not sure what happened. But she had me come over to her house and introduce me to art books. Hmm. Yeah, and there I sat. And she had, I remember, a Currier and Ives book, which I did not care for. It looked very, you know, stilted and contrived, but I was pleased that someone was reinforcing the idea that art was important. Now, let me just quickly mention that part of the charm, part of the excitement, really, of Dutton's book, Art Instinct, is that it operates from the premise that art needs to be restored as the central core experience that it truly must be in a balanced culture. And this has eluded our culture for some time, notwithstanding the kind of lip service status, exalted, almost celebratory status, that art would appear, ostensibly appear to generate. It's mostly just glam. It mostly is a kind of, as I say, lip service, and somewhat indicative of a society that wishes to achieve status, and this has so corrupted the whole endeavor, such that probably starting in the late 70s, early 80s, certainly by the mid 80s, an entire generation of practitioners who only could perceive the model as one of a glamorous life, of status and individual of individual greatness that really eclipsed the work they did, which leads back to Spalding's book, Eclipse of Art.
Before we finish, we're almost out of time. I want to tell all the listeners who tuned in after we started the show that we have been talking with Jim Weidel, painter whose works are going to be in the show, or actually by the time this airs, the show will already be up in Icon Gallery of Contemporary Realism, so you can come and see his wonderful work.
You've been listening to Icon Art Radio, a production of Iowa Contemporary Art, Fairfield.